In the Army, there's an old saying that the commander is responsible for everything the unit does or fails to do. When morale begins to fail in the institution, the culture looks to the top. When the Afghanistan exit began to unravel, veterans and even some active duty looked to top military leadership, mainly the joint chiefs of the branches, as well as the chairman, for responsibility and accountability. Some even angry that stars were not put on the table in the name of protecting and serving the people in the fight. The Budget Control Act in 2011 was the beginning of another one of those seasons, where budget cuts and later sequestration forced the defense to slim down while the U.S. was still heavily engaged in two wars. From 2011 to 2016, the Joint Chiefs testified before Congress about the expectation to fight and win wars while also meeting budget constraints. Here is General Odierno, Joint Chief of the Army, warning Congress in 2013.
I do not consider myself an alarmist. I consider myself a realist. Today's international environment is emerging. Threats require a joint force with a ground component that has the capability and capacity to deter and compel adversaries who threaten our national security interests. The Budget Control Act and sequestration severely threaten our ability to do this.
The more I dug into the frustration felt by those boots on the ground and leveraged curiosity for those carrying the weight of hard decisions at the top, the more messy accountability and responsibility became. I found that most people, regardless of role, rank, or responsibility, were genuinely doing the best they could in the circumstances they found themselves. It turns out the messy part is choosing to believe it. I knew it would be helpful to hear from one of those joint chiefs from that season, to not only get his lessons on leadership, but more importantly, to share what it's really like to make tough decisions at the top that will impact an entire branch. So I invited retired General Norton Schwartz, or Norty as he likes to be called, and his wife Susie to share some of their story. He became the 19th Joint Chief of Staff of the Air Force in 2008, after his predecessor was fired for misplacing nuclear weapons. They served in that role until 2012, as sequestration and exhaustion rippled throughout the military culture. Both boomers, they have continued to invest in their community since. I'm Corey Weathers. You're listening to Military Culture Shift, a limited series podcast on the impact of war, money, and generational perspective on morale, retention, and leadership. So I'm so thrilled to have you guys here. In the book, I talk a lot about specifically those years, feeling the weight and the compounded stress of 7 years, I guess, post 9/11, feeling the Operation Tempos escalate. And you were also the Joint Chief of the Air Force during what I call the great cultural shift that I saw boots on the ground 2011, where we really started to see the impact of budget cuts, the impact of social media coming on the scene. I was reading an article about, and I'm going to ask you here in just a second about you coming in and how, and that interesting process of you coming in as Joint Chief. But I was reading an article this morning talking about how, you know, everybody in the room there, they got notified, you know, on their Blackberries. And I remember that was a huge part of this progression of social media and technology was also happening during this time. So thank you guys so much for jumping on and sharing your story of those years with all of us.
Welcome.
How about if I begin and, you know, I'm sure Susie will have a, her perspective as well. As you may know, we came to the job unexpectedly. It was largely as a result of the relief of our secretary and our predecessor as chief of staff due to misplacing six nuclear weapons for 36 hours. And the bottom line was that was, you know, not something that was a mistake. That was an act of neglect. That's how the civilian leadership saw it, significant enough to result in the relief of both the civilian and military leadership of the Air Force. So as you indicated, you know, we were in, I was in Dayton, Ohio for a four-star meeting. And we were all around the table awaiting the arrival of the Secretary Mike Wynn and the Chief Buzz Mosley for that meeting, and started at 9 o'clock, as I recall. And it's 9:20 or so, and nobody's there yet. And so everybody wonders, you know, que pasa? And then, as you indicated, you know, BlackBerries began to buzz, and everybody looked down and saw that both Wynn and Mosley had been relieved by Secretary Gates. So everybody knew around the table that someone was going to be appointed as a successor on the military side. And I certainly didn't think, and I don't believe Susie saw either, that it would be me, that, you know, there were other candidates in the room. My view, frankly, was that Chili Chilton was probably the leading candidate, you know, an American astronaut, a competent, very competent fighter pilot, and, you know, experienced in space and so on and so forth. But the bottom line is, you know, Susie and I were asked to return to Washington. We'd already been announced for retirement. So needless to say, I think we both felt that we still had some gas in the gas tank. And so when asked, of course, we said yes. And so that's, you know, we returned to Washington as to assume the role. And we worked with a quintessential national security professional in Mike Donnelly as our secretary. So
I want to jump in, Norm. I'm just going to say,
sure.
Corey, one thing I guess I think I want people to know is that everybody has a boss. I think young people look up there and think that these people are making decisions, and everybody, you know, has a boss. And so, you know, we came into that role with very direct instructions from the Secretary of Defense.
Right.
Very direct. And we did our best in the 4 years to do what he had asked us to do. And we had to hit the ground running. And the other thing, the other perspective I think that is important to know is that we had been joint for about 8 years prior to that.
Right.
So when we came into the role, we were still joint. Mm-hmm. And so I hit the ground running on family programs to try to catch up with what the Army and the Marine Corps and the Navy had done. Mm-hmm. At that time, you have to remember, global war on terrorism money was still available, mm-hmm. and had been spent differently by different services. So I worked hard to emulate. Most services copy what the Army does because the Army is big. And not that everything is right, but they have the money to sort of start programs and test them to see whether they work or not.
I always have, if I can jump in, I always have this picture in my mind, since we're Army, that we kind of pilot things while all the other branches are kind of like peeking around the corner saying, like, let's see how this works out.
We absolutely wait to see if it works out. We absolutely do. But only, it's only because of scale. It's not because of, you know, different priorities or whatever. It is, you know, it's scale, and that money, you know, money does create more positions, and you can just have a little tiny flexibility, not a lot. So that's kind of a background how we came in.
No, and it's such an abrupt start with, I think it sounds like a lot of pressure. And I'd love to, you mentioned you came in when there was that GWAP money building or still flowing. Can you guys share a little bit more about what that was like for you to, you know, I mean, you are right, like probably talking and getting ready for retirement, and had a kind of different picture of what was going to happen in the years following. And here you are adjusting course. So would you mind sharing, yes, you were gracious enough and did the best that you could with what was asked of you, but do you mind sharing maybe what that felt like, especially if it was unexpected, to be given that task and that role?
Well, speaking for myself, I think, you know, I think we both saw it as an obligation. that we were asked to step into the breach, if you will, and both of us, you know, were committed to serve to the best of our abilities under the circumstances. And Susie referred to that first engagement with Secretary Gates, where he shared, you know, his expectations and three or four things that he expected us to do. You know, one was get in the fight, quote unquote. There was a perception at the time that the Air Force was reluctantly supporting the missions in Iraq and Afghanistan. Secondly, to improve our relations on Capitol Hill. Third was, interestingly enough, to grow the intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance enterprise. And then, you know, finally, I think, you know, his point was very directly, don't backdoor me. Mm-hmm. And I think we were loyal to that guidance, you know, during that period. But I think
and to be seen.
And to be seen.
You know,
Susie, can you describe a little bit of what that means?
Mm-hmm. People have a perception that the service chief, the job, you know, was in the Pentagon. And the perception is that they just work hard right there, you know, and they go home. But being seen, this is a town of being seen. This is a town of showing up. You can say you support something, but if you don't actually attend it, if you aren't seen, you know, at Arlington on Memorial Day or on, you know, at something for Veterans Day, you have to be seen in this town and to be seen, you know, for the town, but also for your troops. When they look out there at the Super Bowl and the service chiefs are lined up, but a service sends a vice chief, they know the difference. If you go to a charity event, okay, here in town, and every service sends a 4-star and the Air Force sends a 2-star, mm-hmm. the troops and the families know the difference. So that's what it means, is to be seen. And the Air Force had a perception that they didn't always show up for things. So, but I have to say that we did not come in reluctantly. We came in happy. Mm-hmm. We were overjoyed at the opportunity to try to turn the ship. And when I say turn the ship, what I mean is really turn a ship, because you have 4 years and you don't turn it all the way around. You turn it 2 degrees or 5 degrees, and you do your best within the parameters. But, you know, you want to put what you think is important. And we believed in jointness. We believed in supporting the fight to our core. Yeah. We grew up special operations, and we grew up, it's the customer. And the customer is that soldier, sailor, airman, marine in the back about to jump out of that plane, mm-hmm. or that you're about to land and offload. You know, I don't know what the term is, but it's the customer. And so
I love that. And you guys are still very true to your heart for people and your heart for service. Yeah. I would regret not asking, before we unpack your time more, I'd regret, so much of the book covers generational differences in values and motivations and why people come in. That's a big question everybody's asking right now, is the difference of values for Gen Z and millennials and how that's creating some change within the military. Would you mind sharing, both of you sharing your why? Like, why did you join in the first place? Was it something you always wanted to do, was to fly? Share a little bit of your motivation coming in and maybe how that contributed maybe to some of the work ethic that you have stayed with through the course of your life.
Well, I had always had an interest in aviation. And I recall riding my bicycle down to the grass field at the Ocean County Airport in this small town in South Jersey. And, you know, as I was getting on toward considering college opportunities, my older brother was in school in New York. And Dad couldn't quite swing having both of us in school at the same time. So the deal was, you know, to either get a scholarship or wait out 2 years. And one of the counselors suggested, applying to the Naval Academy, in East Coast School. That would be a scholarship, and I might be able to fly for the Navy. Later in the game, someone suggested applying to the Air Force Academy. I didn't even know where Colorado Springs was, at that time, frankly. It turns out, of course, that I didn't get into Annapolis, which was the source of some jest between me and my Navy counterparts over the years. And I was a first alternate to Air Force and ultimately got in. While in the late 60s, military service and particularly being a cadet or a midshipman wasn't the most popular thing. I, for whatever reason, and this is true of Susie as well, we both sort of grew up in family settings where service mattered and service was valued. And so that I saw this as a wonderful opportunity. I did get to go to pilot training and learn how to fly. And I the armed forces was a good fit for me, maybe not for everyone, but certainly for me. And, I started out in a big airplane, the C-130, and which was a good fit for me. And like everyone, at least most of my generation, you aspired to fly a fighter, but that really wasn't the right fit for me. And thankfully, I ended up where I did and migrated to Special Ops, as Susie said, and we spent 25 years there doing very meaningful things. The bottom line was that service and the armed forces was a good fit for me. And I did my best to offer honorable service and to perform to the best of my ability. And the reality is that luck has a lot to do with how things turn out in life. That is certainly true in our case. The likelihood of Susie and me becoming the first family of the United States Air Force was it was not a likely outcome. But it turned out because of circumstances. And so, what a privilege it was to serve in that role. So.
Susie, how about for you? When did you guys get married? And what was the motivation around service and service to your country like?
Sure. I have to be honest, I probably wasn't into service at that time. I mean, I married him. He was a captain about to be a major already. And my father had been in the service, and I swore I would never marry anybody in the service. And
I think we all say that, Susie.
don't we, though? We all do. I mean, honestly, really, we do. So I was a school teacher, and I think that is probably service as well. But I thought it would be easy to transfer and move around with that. And it really wasn't quite as easy as I thought it would be. And we were not married very long, maybe 2 years before he was in a command position. It was kind of thrust on me. You either do or don't. I mean, I don't know. And I didn't think I was ready. I was 30 years old and he was a squadron commander. And I thought, what have I got myself into? And so I was determined I was going to break the mold a little bit. And I tried. I did.
And she did.
I fought the good fight for as long as I could. I think I fought it until he became a 4-star. I really do. I think I fought it as long as I could. But at that point, you realize that you now have an opportunity for yourself. You've already fought the fight, but to continue to fight in a different way within the system and a little bit without. And you feel like you have an opportunity to make a difference as a four-star spouse, unlike any other position, because you know that really there's not much left for your spouse. So how much trouble can you get him in? And in all honesty, you really can't. I mean, I think we still a little bit believe that you can, but you can't. But what you can do is try to change something and make it better for those coming behind you. And so I really felt that obligation. And I did it at Transcom in a different way, but as a service chief spouse, you really do have that, have an opportunity to make a difference. And I hit the ground running. They tell you that it's a marathon, not a sprint. And I will tell you that is a big fat lie. Yeah, it is a 4-year sprint.
Right.
And if you're doing it right every day, you are trying.
Right.
I mean, I will tell you that as we were about to retire, one of the last emails I received was an email about freezing sperm. Okay. And I'm still answering that email in the car on the way to his retirement. Mm. So you're doing it every day to the best that you can. And then we both sort of chose to continue mm-hmm. in that service. A lot of our contemporaries don't do that. And that's okay too.
Yeah.
For us, we enjoyed it. We thought we could still make a difference, and we chose to still make a difference.
Right. So both of us, you know, have followed a nonprofit's path in retirement. And you know, that's a good fit for us. And, you know, hopefully we've got a little few more years of payback, if you will. And then we'll, you know, probably dial back a bit. But the but the bottom line is, you know, I married up in life, and you know, it's a wonderful thing to have a partner like Susie who demands more of you as an individual and as a human being. So,
well, for those who don't know, a lot of us spouses call Susie Mama Susie. She demands a lot of us to be better in the best way. And I'm better, and I am partially who I am today because of your mentoring, Susie. So thank you for what you continue to do and how you stay involved. And I think there's a lot of people listening right now, maybe even some spouses listening, that what you said about trying to fight against certain things, that really resonates with a lot of, I think, families nowadays who are trying to figure out what is best for their family, what is best for especially spouse and employment and all of that. And some do feel like they're kind of fighting, trying to break outside of a certain mold. And I appreciate the balanced approach of the way that you described that, that there is times that you can fight and kind of pave your own way and make things work for you and for your family. And at other times to recognize the benefit and the opportunity that that being in the service provides to be in service to other people. And right. And I think both of you guys have done a really great job of walking that line and continuing that. I think that you guys would be on the younger side of the boomer generation, I believe, if that's right.
Tell the story briefly. Tell the story of the Blue Ribbon panel.
Okay. I think Corey knows this, but and many of the spouses know this, but when my husband was a squadron commander, I was bored. I was doing everything, and I went and got a job. And I knew that it was frowned upon, but I didn't really know how much it was frowned upon. And I kept a secret for about 5 months, and then I blurted it out on a Friday night at the club when there were clubs. And on Monday morning, Nort was called in to his boss's office, and I was called by his boss's spouse. And she said to me, "Is my job more important than your husband's career? And do you want to sacrifice his career because you got a job?" And I said, "Well, I think we can do both." And and Nort said the exact same thing to his boss. And we were left in the position. And I think it turned out okay for the both of us.
Yep.
But shortly after that, the Air Force launched a Blue Ribbon panel, which went around the country and interviewed spouses about working. And out of that really came, for all services, the idea that two for one was no more. And right. And I will say that that is honest to God, the truth. Yep. Still, I believe spouses think that that when their spouse's records are being read, that there is something about them in that record. And I can assure you that there is not. But I felt proud for fighting that fight. And you got to fight it, and you got to be willing to get in trouble. And I continued to try to work and, you know, do both. Later in life, he was a commander again, and I didn't move down to Florida. So yeah. He was living in the commander's house. And in those days, it was really housing for families. And he was down there for about 5 months. And he said, "Are you ever coming?" And he said, "I think people are looking in the windows, you know, to see if I was coming." And I did come.
One of the things I'm thinking about as you guys are sharing that story is, and please correct me if you would see this a different way, is that sometimes the system makes appropriate changes and it takes a while for humans to follow and they're changing their belief system, changing the long, you know, held traditions and beliefs that have been maybe in that system for a very long time. And then there's other times that humans catch on to, and leadership catch on to, changes that need to be made before the system can make those changes.
Right. And I will tell you, as honestly looking back, you know, I was angry about all that. And now as he became more senior, I realized that the service heard me and others. Mm-hmm. And that's why they launched the Blue Ribbon panel, you know, and they heard it. And I think that is a message for young people, no matter what generation they are, is that they do hear you and the system moves slower. And also to continue that fight, I will say that almost every family program that any service has today is because of families fighting the good fight for it. All of it, you know, from Aaron and Family Readiness Centers. All of it is because families continue to fight the fight. And sometimes it takes longer than others. Mm-hmm. I think that we think that the next generation is always more impatient. I don't think that's necessarily true. I mean, I was impatient. I wanted it right then. and I didn't understand why they were like that. I didn't understand it. But it does take time. Mm-hmm. So I think spouses can pat themselves on the back, really, because they continue to fight. I feel like each generation maybe is braver than the one that went before it.
I think so too. So I'm already seeing the millennial generation doing some very interesting fights and in a lot of cases advocating for some new changes that I think could be really fantastic, and that there's a lot that are leaving and there's a lot that are actually in there fighting. And I'm really excited about what could be coming. I'd love to dig in a little bit more into what your time was like in that 2008 to 2012. I experienced boots on the ground, that 2011 shift, where that was where I on the Army side started to see what I now know was the impact of some of those budget cuts coming down and changes in civilian jobs and how that would impact access to programming or access to maybe the speed of resources. So that was a little bit of what we were seeing. But what I now also realize was this was a lot of social media coming on the scene and really shifting our military culture for the beginning of that shift of going from a very in-person culture that I thankfully was able to experience prior to that, the neighbors supporting each other, just everybody coming together and being a family to each other, to post 2011, where things really started to go online. So I would love to know from your perspective at the top, did you experience that shift? And then we'll kind of get into money here in a second and what you saw, especially as you were trying to support these both conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. But did you experience any of that shift as well?
Sure, we did. But I must say that I, you know, Susie was well ahead of me. I was sort of a Neanderthal on the social media thing, and I did not maintain a Facebook page or what have you. I was still very traditional in that sense. The more internal means of communications to the force and so on. Susie, on the other hand, was quite active and to great effect. I think that was one of those sort of seminal shifts that probably required more than one chief's tenure. Mm-hmm. And generating comfort in communicating in a more wholesale way, or I should say a more retail way, through social media and so on and so forth. And it took time for the institutions, all the services to adapt. That's for sure.
Can I ask, you mentioned the BlackBerry early on. I had a Marine couple talk about the shift even in their home of his ability to turn work off drastically shifted once the BlackBerry came on the scene. So do you remember going from doing the job without that access to technology to then suddenly having that technology in your hand?
I think it was less the mobile aspect than the network aspect. As we grew up, certainly in the late 80s and beyond, the networks began to proliferate and were accessible from other than the workplace. And as Susie knows very well, and I probably, to excess, the reality was that the business, the leadership business, is a 24/7 thing, and I probably, practiced that to excess. But the bottom line was that, however we were connected, certainly meant that we were, a part of a 24/7 sort of obligation, and did our best to fulfill that obligation.
So for you, like you said, hitting the ground running for those 4 years was a sprint. Like, you saw that as a 24/7 regardless role. And so whether it was by phone or mobile phone or BlackBerry, you were going to be accessible.
Yeah. And, kids were dying. What else were we to do? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What else would we have considered doing? No, it was, as Susie said, it was a sprint from start to finish.
I
really feel that young people don't understand just the commitment to those young people. Yeah. It is all about those young people.
It's about the kids.
It is about the kids. And we say kids.
Yes.
But everything that you do all day long, every day, is to keep them as safe as you can.
Yes.
Give them the tools. Not to give them everything. That's not it. There's always choices. But I just don't think they realize how much you care about them. I'm going to give you an example. Do you remember? You don't remember, I don't think. But there was a time when we had to keep our Army units from 12 months to 15 months.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right when we came in. Yeah.
And it was horrible. Mm-hmm. It was horrible. And the chairman of the Joint Chiefs came in to speak to the senior spouses with tears running down his face. And I'm crying as I remember this, because to say that he did not want to do this, and there was just really no choice at that time.
It's true.
And so when Nort says that it's 24/7, it is 24/7. It is constant. And he was on the computer. In some ways, they were ahead, because special ops was a little bit ahead sometimes, computers early on in the home, whatever. And basically, he was on the computer 24 hours a day. I mean, literally. I would say that he got up at 4, he checked his email, he went to run. He came home, he checked his email. And then you're on the BlackBerry, you're driven to work. And while, yes, that is a treat, you're driven to work because you're checking emails on the way to work.
Well, and Susie, you described like answering emails on the way to retirement, right?
Yes. So this is, yeah.
You know, there's a now I almost like aged myself. I was going to say nowadays, you know, but like today, social media has become a place where everybody can express opinions and thoughts and yes. feelings and opinions. You know, lots of divisiveness on that. But the point is, there's a lot of veterans and also a lot of those that are still in that you'll see on social media will say things about not just general officers, but those making decisions at the top as if they're detached or as if they are making decisions. I don't want to say for themselves, but there seems to be just kind of this messaging that as if those don't understand. And so what would you say to those who maybe are boots on the ground? You were already starting to talk about the commitment, maybe a little bit of the burden that comes with the opportunity to do what you guys did. But what do you feel like those boots on the ground don't understand about some of the decisions, many of them being very tough decisions that you have to make at the top?
My experience is that the uniform military colleagues that we served with were consistently selfless. There were a couple of exceptions, but very few. I think it's important for, you know, the boots on the ground to distinguish between the professional national security folks that are both civilian and military, and what I would call the politicals, the appointed officials, or the elected officials for that matter. Typically, they have a little different perspective. They're more self-centered, I would argue, as you know, a rule of thumb. It's because of their role, I suppose, and that they tend to have a lesser appreciation for the institutions in which they serve. That's not true for those in uniform. You know, every one of our colleagues understood the institutional aspects of their job, the necessity for preserving the culture, preserving the ethics, preserving the reputation of the institution for the American people. That's my take. And so I just, you know, would recommend to all to try to distinguish between those that are national security professionals, dedicated professionals, and those perhaps that are more part-time.
Can you share what is, I'm trying to figure out how to word this because it goes along with what you were just describing. Today's, especially younger generations, are asking for, if not demanding, more authenticity. And it sounds like at that level, you are not only committed, not only have a lot on your plate, but also are doing it with that motive of selfless service and trying to do the best you can in the role that you're in. Mm-hmm. I imagine there's also mixed in that a lot of OPSEC and things that can't be said out loud, as well as adversaries that are watching and allies that are watching things that you're saying. So I think a lot of times people are looking at the top going, why can't they say more? Why can't they be more authentic? Why can't they say whatever, fill in the blank? Do you have a way of describing what that is like or what that feels like to be able to maybe not be as authentic or as transparent in that role, and maybe why it's difficult to be as transparent?
Because in the end, the uniformed officials in this country, there's a thing called civilian supremacy. And we all work for ultimately the commander in chief, but it lower down in the stack, there's, as Susie said, everyone has a boss, and it is typically a civilian official. And in the end, you have to balance the needs for authenticity to the workforce with the expectations of the appointed leadership. It requires a balancing act. It's an interactive sort of thing when you have to decide, you know, is this one of those occasions when you might express a different view than your senior, or you know, is the approach better to make the case and to bang the table in private? Loyalty matters in these circumstances, and loyalty is a vital attribute in armed forces at any level. It's what allows us to do extraordinary things, mm-hmm. and to demand that others do extraordinary things.
You really have to pick your battles.
Yes.
Or else it would be a battle every single day. Mm-hmm. And for the service chiefs, the perception is that they battle in the tank. And that is not true.
Right.
For the most part, it is a give and take. It is an honest discussion. Okay. And it is meeting the needs at the time. And sometimes it swings one way and it swings another way. So it's respectful. And it's the long game.
It is the long game.
It's the long game. And if you know the old adage about do you want your message that you spout out on Instagram or on Facebook, do you want that on the cup, on the above the fold on the Washington Post? And that is no. And so you really... You know, you learn over time to check yourself. I don't check myself as well as my husband does because the Air Force wasn't paying me. And I always said that when they wrote me a check, then I would keep my powder dry. But occasionally you do stop yourself at 11:30 at night because whatever email you're writing at that moment probably isn't a good one. And if you sleep on it, it might be just a little bit better and it might be better received.
So one of the lessons learned that I'm hearing from you guys right now is that there are some leadership positions that we will find ourselves in where we have to walk the line between when we're authentic and transparent and when it is respectful to kind of bite our tongue and wait things out, and to figure out how to lead everyone with the right information for the right reasons. And that sometimes we can't give all the information yet.
Right.
I think both of those answers were so powerful. So thank you for that. And there's a lot that we could unpack and learn from that. Since we're going to be out of time soon, I'd love to ask, you guys were in that role when the Budget Control Act came out. Sequestration was 2013, which is really, I think, that the heavier hitting years for sure. But can you describe what some of those conversations were like? You know, I felt that great cultural shift, as I call it, in 2011, but really 2014, 15 things, I think, on the family side, boots on the ground, is really the weight of what we were all feeling. When the force started to really get tired, I think, too, and enough shifts had happened that it was just kind of this cultural snowball of things that were happening. So what was some of those conversations like when the Budget Control Act was starting to roll out?
Well, I'll give you one inside view from the tank that there clearly was angst amongst the chiefs. But again, you know, this was a case of civilian supremacy, both in the executive and the legislative branch. And so what the chairman did one day when we were all there was to say the following: there'll be no knife fights in public. We will deal with this at the table, and we will have a collective position and it'll be our position. And I'll never forget, no knife fights in public. And that was the way this group of Joint Chiefs operated. And another quick vignette, which Susie knows well. One of the consequences of sequestration, I made a promise to George Casey, who was then the chief of the Army, that I would support his tactical airlift needs, which allowed him to dispose of certain airlift type aircraft that the Army was operating for last tactical mile kinds of delivery of equipment and supplies. I promised him that we would not welch on that. He could depend on it. Well, in the sequestration scenario, even while we were still there, it was about a 10% decrement. And one of the things that went away by necessity was the equipment that would have supported that commitment to George. So I had to go see him. I had to go tell him that I was backing out on a promise I gave. And in our business, at that level, promises given are promises kept. And, you know, George, of course, understood. But think of the implications. George went out on a limb saying, trust this guy from mm-hmm. the Air Force. And I came back some months later and perhaps proved to some that I wasn't trustworthy. Not an ideal circumstance, but that was the environment in which we lived at that moment.
I can only imagine. When I was researching and writing about those years, I kept thinking about how difficult it must have been with the calling that you guys just described as far as your reasons for coming in, the commitment and loyalty that you made in your hearts to serve, taking care of these kids, right? And then to be in a situation where you had to make those hard decisions and back out of promises that you were making, knowing that it was going to impact those that you felt you were coming in to serve in the first place. And I kept thinking about how difficult that must have been. And of course, all we have on record is not those conversations in the tank, but more so those testimonies before Congress. Right. And so, of course, those testimonies are very regulated and controlled. Again, no knife fights in public. And so I just have this kind of empathic picture in my mind of what that must have been like, not only during the years that you were serving, but watching in retirement as even more cuts were made, what that must have been like.
Well, you know, Corey, let me push back a little bit on that.
Please, please.
When we came into the job in 2008, the DOD budget was $350 billion. Today, the agreement is $886.
Yes, which I would love to hear your thoughts on.
So candidly, that is a lot of American treasure. So the reality that there has been this dramatic retrenchment, I think, is a little bit of an exaggeration. I mean, there's money. The question is, what are we applying it to?
Yeah.
And as you are well aware, there are many chefs in deciding where that money is applied. But the budget trajectory has accelerated. Mm-hmm. That for that brief moment, there was a decrement, the BCA that you referred to, but it was very brief, as it turned out.
So what I hear you saying is there's in the up and down of the budget, there's the really good question of, should we be spending that much in the first place? Does the Budget Control Act and sequestration protect us from inflating that budget further and spending more than we should? And sometimes even as parents, you know, there's risk in giving your kids too much freedom, too much spending, too many toys, too many whatever. And so there has to be kind of that restraint and developing self-control. That's a little bit of what I'm hearing too.
I was going to jump in there and say that with unlimited money comes not always wise choices.
Right.
Yeah.
And so when you are given a restraint, it forces you to make those choices.
Discipline.
Let me give you an example. For the Air Force family programs, and again, family programs is a very small part of the budget. Mm. So I just, you know, I pushed back with you earlier when we spoke about the idea that they immediately look to cut family programs.
Yeah.
As everyone says, that's budget dust. And that's not big enough to make an impact. However, everything matters. So the Air Force looked. We took 6 months, I think it was, and we went around the country at every single installation and looked at every single program for families, REC, the BX, the commissary, you know, all of it. And we racked and stacked it basically at each installation. And at some places we closed golf courses, which people make fun of the Air Force for their golf courses. But in the old days, the golf courses paid for everything else on the base. But in the shift, what we wanted was to make sure that they were A, being used, but B, were the troops using them? Were they only open for the retirees? Is that why we have a golf course? So, you know, we looked at everything and did some shifts and shifted money away from things that were maybe not as well used into ones that the troops used. They used outdoor rec, okay? And it forces you to actually look at stuff that you think is working great, and you got to make choices. And so we made a lot of choices. I was just at my mother's house, and in Little Rock Air Force Base, where a beautiful golf course is closed because the troops wanted something else. That course was losing money. You cannot operate something continuously if it is losing money when the budget becomes a little constrained. And that's not all bad to force you to realize what's working and what isn't.
Well, I think what may have happened during those years where everybody was feeling it was a mix of a lot of families who had really gotten used to money flowing and programs. And I mean, when we were in the chaplain corps, we were doing marriage retreats out of Colorado for $40,000 in a weekend, right? Mm-hmm. Like we were living the life doing retreats in Breckenridge, right? So there was definitely especially when you have families coming in and that is their imprinting and their experience of military culture. And then for that to go away, I think there was a lot of disruption that, to your point, we needed some adjustments and people were going to have a hard time making those adjustments. What I also read though, was when you're making those adjustments, especially in those later years, when you're still in Iraq and Afghanistan, that was really hard. So would you say the same was needed? The same was true during those conflicts that we needed to find a way to spend less? Or was there a little bit harder of a push and pull and needing to stay in those conflicts with budget cuts?
Again, we responded to, you know, the what the Congress appropriated for the Department of Defense to operate. And so, as Susie indicated, you know, we made choices large and small. And I personally believe that in my experience, a bit of fiscal discipline is good for any institution, you know. And so the bottom line is that there was a period of time when almost any good idea got funded.
Yeah, I feel like I remember that.
I will also say that military leadership in the Pentagon does not decide when and where we pull out or countries. I will tell you that. So
we offer best military advice.
Right. So while
Which
we're
I think
in
is
those
also
countries, we're going to provide them with what they need. But
I think that's also, again, going back to those difficult decisions and doing the best you can during that sprint. Sure. Thank you for answering that. And I know that was a delicate question, but so well said. And I think that educates so much of us, so many of us, on understanding where we are today. Again, the more research I did, the more complicated it becomes, right? When you see all the many variables that go into these decisions, what keeps us, what influences us, what gives us what we need, who gives us what we need. Like, it's just an endless rabbit trail of variables and contributing factors. Is there anything else that you feel, either of you feel like you wish people understood? Maybe if you wanted to say something to the younger generation, what would you want them to understand given your time in and now seeing what you're seeing today? What encouragement would you offer?
I would just emphasize that the country needs good people to do this stuff, that there is nobility in public service, in uniform or out. The country needs good people to do this stuff.
And I will say that there have been ebbs and flows over time, and that will continue to be. I just want to, like he said, service matters, whatever it is. Right. So if you're not going to serve, you know, maybe you encourage someone else to serve, but it does make a difference. And to know that old people do have some knowledge and experience. They're not smarter than you for sure, but they live through the ups and downs and they know that we can get through it.
It's called perspective.
Yeah.
Beautifully said. Thank you guys so much for your time and your investment in this community and your continued investment in this community. I just so appreciate both of you and your story. And it was really important to me that if we're going to talk about multi-generational teamwork, that we need that perspective. We need that perspective on our history. We need that perspective on what's happening today. And I'm really grateful that you guys would be willing to give this time. So thank you guys for joining me.
We end though, I'm just going to say thank you to you and to say how proud we are of younger generations. We love what you do. We might make a face. We might not agree with everything, but we are cheering you on loudly and proudly every single day.
The world has gone mad, ruthless and insane. I'm right, you're wrong, I'm right, are the rules of the game. And meanwhile, people are dying in every corner of the world, either starving or murdered or by damage deemed collateral. Maybe I'd be just as blind, content like I used to be, caught up in what the Tar Heels were doing, reclining and watching TV. If I weren't in Iraq, choking on desert sand, rolling tonight, locked and loaded off to kill my fellow man. And I just don't get it, Lord, I just don't get it. And I hope I never do.
In the book, I write about reaching out to our former commander in the wake of the Afghanistan withdrawal. People all over the country were demanding accountability of leaders, shouting with digital courage that they would take nothing less than watching the Joint Chiefs resign in defiance. When I asked retired Colonel Brown about the messages circulating, he reminded me of what Norty shared too, that military leaders are servants, advising on military strategy, but like Susie said, answering to those in authority over them. This is an uncomfortable reality because when you follow the blame, it ultimately points back to us, citizens with the opportunity to change the course of our nation with a vote. And while there should also be accountability at every level of responsibility, when we play the long game, we realize that we will all eventually find ourselves judged by those we've led, and history revealing if we got it right.
Life is shitty when you're at war. The fellas doing the fighting and dying are the last to know what for. But we hear there's a reason, must be some noble cause. But I've seen the effect of the cause that you're preaching, and I don't like it at all. Cause I've seen my buddies broken and blind,
26-year-old crippled now with an 8-year-old's mind. And the speeches, they keep coming, and Congress whines and moans, then takes a well-deserved long vacation at one of their 3 homes. And I just don't get it, Lord, I just don't get it. And I hope I never do.
The Military Culture Shift podcast is sponsored by New Res and written and produced by me, author, speaker, and military clinical consultant Corey Weathers. The closing credit song is I Just Don't Get It, written, produced, and performed by veteran James Corbin. This is a supplemental leadership podcast for the book Military Culture Shift, The Impact of War, Money, and Generational Perspective on Morale, Retention, and Leadership. Copies of the book can be purchased on Amazon, militaryfamilybooks.com, and your other favorite retailers. More information, including graphs, data, and other resources mentioned in the book, can be found on my website, coreyweathers.com.
So where is Sergeant Bush, Privates Kennedy, or Lott? Are their lives worth more than the men beside me? Well, I sure think not. So what's it matter to them? What's their sacrifice? And D.C. is Vegas and they're playing craps, and our lives are the dice. And I just don't get it, Lord, I just don't get it. And I hope I never do. And I hope I never do. And I hope I never do.